This is Dr. Richard Barone. I'm continuing my oral history interview for the Vietnam Archive Oral History Project with Mr. Steve Dan. Today is May 5th, 2005, and it's 8:20 a.m. Central Standard Time, and I'm again in Lubbock, Texas, and Steve, you are in Colorado Springs. Let's continue with discussing your time and country, and if you would, Steve, could you describe what it was mentally, emotionally, also physically, when you walked point? You mentioned that you did this. Could you tell or describe in general what this was and what kind of effect did it have upon you?
The guy that was walking point, I guess the first thing you got to say is that was the first guy in line, or the guy who was in the front of the line, usually it was some type of patrol.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you were walking a trail. Sometimes you might be in the middle of an open area. Sometimes you might be walking through the jungle or the woods someplace. But it was the guy that was responsible for a couple of things. Trying to make sure that the path that you were taking was safe, or trying to identify problems or the enemy in front of you, or trying to in many cases, for instance, when we were operating out on the Batangan Peninsula, it really became a job of more than anything spotting mines.
Right. That was one of the heaviest mined areas.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Or at least it was a lot more heavily mined than when we were operating out west of Chulai.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was Walking Point a position of honor or respect?
I guess I never really thought about that, but I'm not sure the word honor comes into play, but I think that there was a lot of respect that was given to whoever was walking point. You know, I think sometimes I think that sometimes guys thought that the guy who was walking point was nuts.
Right. I think maybe people listening to this are going to think, wow, I mean, that's, if you don't want to be somewhere, you don't want to be out there.
Well, that's, but on the other hand, I mean, it's, I don't ever remember anybody, you know, being told they were going to walk point. It was, and I don't remember anybody volunteering to walk point. I mean, it was just kind of a job that got assumed.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody, you know, you just kind of all of a sudden that's where your orientation was
mm-hmm.
towards.
Mm-hmm. How did it affect you when you did it?
Let me say something else here. I think that there's if you're going to take that position, that you have to have a certain amount of self-confidence. And if I can use a, you know, a sporting analogy,
of course.
You know, if you're playing quarterback or you're playing halfback at a football team, you want a guy who you're going to hand the ball off to, who has got the ball, who's got a lot of confidence that they're going to get the play made.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you know, if you don't have a lot of self-confidence in going into that kind of position, then it isn't going to work. For the same reason that it isn't going to work if you hand off a ball to a halfback who has got in the back of his mind, I don't want to fumble.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sure as hell, he's going to fumble.
Right.
You know, it's almost an automatic. So you're
saying that you've got to, not only do you have to know what you're doing, you know, tactically, but you need to have in your mind that, okay, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it well.
Right.
Okay.
And you know, I hesitate to use the word cocky, but you come kind of almost have to be that way. You have to believe that you're good at it, and you're going to do a good job.
Mm-hmm. Was that the case with you? Is that how you were?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I thought that although I was, you know, always apprehensive and adrenaline was flowing 1,000 miles an hour, mm-hmm. You know, but I felt like I knew what I was doing and that the cockiness comes out, but I felt like that in some cases, it was better off that I was doing it than somebody else was.
Like you could control your own destiny.
Right.
How long would one need to be out in the field before they would have confidence in themselves? I guess this is personality dependent as well, but confident in themselves to walk point. Or able to be appointed or kind of rotated into walking point.
Well, I think I was out in the field for a few months at least. I got there in February, and I think I was walking point. I was point man of my squad, I think, in about, it's hard to remember. Probably May or somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was later than that. Probably June.
So
a few months. I was probably an infield a few months mm-hmm. before I was walking point.
Okay. Do you remember any incidents that specifically happened to you while on point?
Well, yeah, I was. That's when I got wounded.
Yeah.
That's probably the most significant.
It's pretty significant.
Pretty significant.
Do you want to talk about that incident?
Sure, we can.
Okay.
We were out west of Chulai someplace. Mm-hmm. Part of this relates to a story I was telling earlier about some sergeants who I thought didn't have their act together.
Yes.
And we had a new squad leader, a guy who had been transferred up from, I think it was 4th Infantry, but don't hold me to that.
Mm-hmm.
He had been operating down south, and I think that they were starting to ship part of his unit home. Don't hold me to that either. I mean, that's just kind of recollections that I have, but I could be totally wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he came into the squad. We were coming off we had been operating off of some hilltop. I think we'd been out there for a couple of weeks and patrolling the areas during the day and going off the hills and setting up ambushes at night. And we were operating in platoon strength, and our squad was the point squad, and I was on point that day, and we had been. We were looking for a trail to take us up to another hilltop, and I think that there had been some activity reported by some helicopter who had been, flying over someplace somewhere. Anyway, we came off the hill, we came down into this valley, we were walking across this valley, and I wanted to, we're walking right out into the middle of this kind of wide open field, and the grass was about knee or thigh high, and I wanted to get along the tree line
mm-hmm.
because it would provide more, I thought it was safer and would provide more cover,
sure.
Whereas we were just kind of sitting out in the open. So I remember getting to this, so I stopped and I went back and told the sergeant that, you know, I wanted to maneuver back up along the tree line and still head the same direction, mm-hmm. but I felt like we would be a lot safer. And for whatever reason, he didn't want to do that. Almost felt like he wanted to see some action and draw some fire and whatever his reasons were. We got into a big heated argument, and he just finally pulled rank and said, "Move it right down on the line that you're at." And so I'd lost my cool and my temper, and I wasn't thinking as well as I should have been because I was so hot under the collar.
Mm-hmm.
But it came to a point where we were came to a hedgerow, and on the other side of the hedgerow was a trail. I thought that there was a trail there, but I didn't know for sure. Anyway, I was so pissed, I just went crashing through this hedgerow,
mm-hmm.
and followed by the. We had a dog team with us that day, so the dog and his handler was behind me, and I got onto this. I got onto this trail and took about two or three steps, and a mine went off underneath and behind me.
Okay.
And blew me up in the air, and I landed on my stomach with, and then I, you just kind of lose it for, 10 seconds, and so I remember getting up and running about 5 or 6 yards, and then falling, and then thinking, what the hell are you doing? And I fell down on my face and had my rifle up in front of me, and I was pointing it, trying to figure out, okay, what's going on and who's coming at me where and so on. At that point, I could hear people start coming up behind us,
mm-hmm.
Going, okay, what happened? Who's hit? Where's Dant? Because I guess I'd gone through a little, I getting blown up the trail a little bit, and then I ran 5 yards, so I was kind of a little out of sight of when the people came through the hedgerow behind me.
Mm-hmm.
And then the guys found me, and they set up a little perimeter, and the medic started working on my leg where I'd caught some shrapnel in my back. And I was lucky in that I mostly got hit by the concussion of the thing.
Right.
The dog took most of the shrapnel.
Mm-hmm.
If the dog hadn't have been there, I'd probably have been much more seriously hurt.
Do you know what kind of booby trap it was?
Exactly? I have no idea. My bet is it was some kind of Chi-Com grenade of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
But it could have been some kind. I mean, I don't know. It could have been some handmade thing.
Nevertheless, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, right.
It worked. And
it worked. And whether it was a tripwire or hell, it may have been something that just. Had been laying in that hedgerow, waiting for somebody to bump it to come out.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it wasn't a mine at all. A piece of ordnance that never went off, and we just wrestled it free. But my bet is it was some kind of mine that had been planted near that hedgerow, next to the trail,
mm-hmm.
I still believe to this day, if I hadn't lost my cool and I hadn't been pissed off at the time, I would have gone much more carefully through that hedgerow and maybe spotted something.
Right. So what was the result there? You come to a rest, you're dazed. What's going on?
What do you mean, after I'm hit?
Yeah, I mean, are you evacuated? Are you?
Yeah,
what do
I,
you
was,
do?
I was, I had two... I had a bunch of scrapes and cuts in my back and two pretty good-sized holes in the back of my left leg.
Mm-hmm.
I was lucky it didn't hit an artery or anything, so it ended up kind of being big flesh wounds.
Right.
So they tied those off, and the dog handler had been hit. The mine had gone off in front of him, and I think... he lost an eye through the whole thing.
Hmm.
So anyway, they called for a dust off, and happened to be a loach flying over the area. I think it was probably the same guy who had spotted the activity on the hillside that we were headed for. And so he radioed in that he was in the area and he would pick us up. So. We had to walk a couple hundred yards to to a place where he could land, and they put us on a the Loach helicopter and flew us back to Chulai.
Hmm. Okay. And when you got back to Chulai, what happened?
Well, they met us with a couple of well, they weren't gurneys. I don't know what they were. Some kind of cots that they put you on, and that's where I lost touch with the dog was pretty beat up. I noticed that when we were riding back in the helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I asked the handler how he was doing. He goes, other than my eye, I think I'm okay.
Mm-hmm.
But he was kind of stunned. We got off on a tarmac and a couple of, I guess it was a doctor and probably a nurse and a few orderlies or whatever. I mean,
mm-hmm.
hauled me into the operating room and they wanted to know where I was hit and I told them and so they kind of going over the whole area and I, you know, at that point they, you know, it's at some point I noticed that in the operating room everybody kind of relaxed because and I. I kind of thought, well, that's a pretty good sign.
Okay.
It must, you know, must just be, you know,
yeah,
something they're going to sew me up and set me free, and that's pretty much what happened. But I remember the doctors that were operating on me. It seemed like one of these guys was coming on to the nurse.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
One of the doctors?
Yeah.
You remember this?
Yeah. I thought it was funny.
Yeah.
And she was kind of cute, so you know, I hadn't seen a round eye in a while, so.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of neat. But they patched me up, and I had, I think the wounds were big enough that they really couldn't do much in terms of stitching. They had to wait a couple days before they could do that.
Mm-hmm.
So they put a lot of gauze and disinfectant and wrapped a good part of my upper back thigh and sent me back to my company, what did you call it, back to the compound.
Mm-hmm.
The top sergeant was kind of surprised to see me,
mm-hmm.
and he thought I'd be in the hospital for a couple of days.
Yeah.
And after I'd been back there a couple of days, he started putting me on guard duty, and I don't think he was supposed to do that because I was having to report to an aid station like a couple times a day to have these bandages changed
because
mm-hmm. they were more afraid of anything that like a lot of things over there. The biggest problem with my wounds is the danger of getting infected.
Right.
And trying to keep them clean. So he sent me out on guard duty one night, and my wounds started oozing, and the bandages were getting all wet and leaking, and so I had to call back to the rear to get somebody to replace me, and he was pretty pissed about that. But then when I went back to the medic station,
mm-hmm.
and they found out that I'd been put out on guard duty.
Mm-hmm.
That doctor who was there really went after top and told him this guy's not to be on any kind of duty like that. Very light around the compound, and if he ends up getting an infection, I'm holding you personally responsible.
Wow. Okay.
So he left me alone after that. I think that top had a little more respect for what had happened,
mm-hmm.
And I think I was in the rear a month or so, and then...
Steve, hold on. What was it like being in the rear versus being in the field? That's got to be a pretty big difference.
Yeah, well, it was especially different for me because I was recuperating. I really didn't have a job.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it was wonderful being in the rear and not being out in the field, but you know, I was also bored as hell.
Mm-hmm. What'd you do with yourself?
Well, I did have some light duty that I had to perform, like helping the company clerk out with some stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, typing and some filing and that kind of thing. I'd, you know, run errands. I'd clean up the compound. I went every night to the EM Club and drank about 18 beers.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I read a lot.
Do you remember what you were reading?
No, I just, you know, picking up novels and, you know, just kind of killing time.
Did you want to get back out there with the unit, or were you good to go?
You know, ultimately, I wanted to get back to my unit. I kind of felt, you know, between being bored and I felt guilty after a while.
Mm-hmm.
I'd see these guys come back, it was good to see them again.
Mm-hmm.
And I did end up going and spending, I think, a couple weeks, as I remember. You know, I wasn't quite ready to go back to the field, but I could go someplace where I could have some fairly heavy duty. So they sent me out to some fire base to pull guard duty for a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then they sent me back. And then at that point, I said that I think it was at that point I said, look, I want to get back to my unit. And so a couple days after that, they flew me back to Chulai, and my unit, I think, was coming in on stand down, and that's when I rejoined and I went back to the field.
Okay. What was your reception like when you got back out there?
They thought that I was out of my friggin' mind.
Because you wanted back, or you came back?
Yeah, because I came back, yeah. And I guess maybe I was, but... Mm-hmm. I don't know why I did it to this day, but just felt like it was the right thing to do at the time.
Well, when you got back out, were you as aggressive, less aggressive? Were you the same? What were you like in the field? Were you kind of looking a little more carefully, or trying not to lose your temper, or focus more?
But I don't remember. You know, being any different in the field than I was before.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember this, but you know, I guess we all learn our lessons. I do remember that sergeant wasn't around anymore. I don't know what happened to him, and I don't even remember who the new sergeant was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I must have been walking point again, but, you know, your most vivid memories are probably like, you know, like the rest of life. You remember a lot of times when the places that you really screw up are the things that really stand out in your mind, as opposed to the times that you were doing something in walking point and nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of those days.
Yeah. So that was the most common day, basically.
Pardon me?
That was the most common day, basically?
The most common day of being out in walking point is, as I said earlier, I mean, it's a lot of adrenaline and you're just, the focus that you have is just very intense. I mean, you're just, your eyes are just everything about you is very intense. You're trying to see everything, hear everything,
mm-hmm.
notice everything that's out in front of you and on your periphery.
Mm-hmm.
Just taking care to make sure that you're not walking into an ambush.
Mm-hmm.
Or that you're not about to hit a mine.
Right. Well, are there any more incidents that come to mind? I mean, that's a major one. But what else after this point, as far as contact or just things that happened that come to mind now that you remember?
There are a couple of other incidents that come biggest to mind. One, mm-hmm. and I think I mentioned this earlier, was being and in Dragon Valley, which was, and I, if you were to hand me a map, I would probably have a hard time finding it. But we walked into this area, and I wasn't walking point by then, so I was probably in country maybe 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, as country, come to think about it, that was walking out of there was the first time I'd walked point. But I've forgotten about that. Anyway, a valley that kind of hills on, as you're walking in, hills up in front of us and to the right of us, almost a semicircle of hills that you're walking into.
Mm-hmm.
And we started taking a lot of incoming and we called a we set ourselves up in a defensive position, and we called in artillery to on the hillsides that we thought that the fire was coming from, and that calmed down for a while, and then I remember we decided to stay there for the night. Why we decided to do that when we weren't on the high ground was beyond me.
Mm-hmm.
Sometime that night we were taking more incoming off and on, and the next morning there was a lot of commotion because during early morning hours or during one of the exchanges of fire, discovered that guy was about three foxholes down from mine had been shot in the head.
Mm-hmm.
And killed, and we had a couple other people that were wounded.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was, you know, sometime after we discovered that and people were moving around, that I think we started taking fire again, and guy from I was in third squad. Guy in first squad got shot in the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were calling in dust off. And I still see Jerry at these. I met Jerry for the first time in 30 years at this reunion a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so we called in a dust off, and a helicopter came in and landed probably, 25, 30 yards in front of the position that I was in.
Mm-hmm.
And me and I think two or three other guys were ordered to get Jerry onto a poncho liner, and the doc was still treating him. And when the dust off landed, we were told to carry him out to the helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And none of us were very happy about that.
Yeah,
because we were taking fire, and we knew we were going to be running him out there in the middle of this open field. And we all loved Jerry to death. We weren't sure we liked him that much.
Right.
What'd you
say to him when you saw him at the reunion for the first time?
God, I don't know. We just kind of hugged each other for a while.
Yeah.
I said, "How you doing?" He said, "I'm doing fine." You know, and he remembered I had a nickname in the field.
Yeah.
You know, my last name is Dant.
Yes.
And Jerry hung this on me. There's a mm-hmm. bourbon that's made in Kentucky, a small distillery called J.W. Dant,
mm-hmm.
and they make mostly bourbon, but they make some other stuff. And apparently, Jerry used to drink some of this stuff in his wilder days. And
mm-hmm.
so when we first met, he started calling me J.W. Pretty soon, the whole company was calling me JW, uh-huh. and so that's the name I went by for the entire time I was in the field.
Wow, okay.
So when I saw him 30 years later, he goes, JW, how you doing? And my wife goes, I know you told me that, but I really didn't believe it till somebody called you that.
What? How did that make you feel after that long hearing that again?
Strange, very weird.
Yeah.
You know, but it, you know, you get away from this for 30 years and you go, did I really go through this mm-hmm. all again? So when you hear something like that, it kind of validates the fact that, okay, I guess I really was there and I did do all this shit.
Yeah. Do you look back, are you sometimes amazed that, wow, I survived that. I made it through something that intense.
Every day.
Really?
Yep. I still can't believe that I did some of the things that I did in Vietnam.
What, the crazy stuff or just the firefights?
Just the experience in itself. I mean, that I actually went through that. Mm-hmm. That I actually was in a firefight that was Walking Point, was mm-hmm. Pinned down in a valley.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
All of that. I mean, life in the United States of America is a very good place to be.
We can talk
after you've been through an experience like Vietnam.
Yeah, I can only imagine, and I want to talk about that when we get to the point chronologically. After you come home and just kind of doing some reflection, did you think at the time in Vietnam about something like that? That God, I just want to get through this and get on with my life.
Well, that's absolutely. You know, it's why I turned down a number of times that I could get out of the field. You know, mm-hmm. where the army would come offer you to go back to the States to go to school if you'll re-up for another 2 years or something, or mm-hmm. join. Go back and go to officers' candidate school, and you know we'll get which would have gotten you out of Vietnam for a while, or go learn to fly a helicopter or whatever. But I just I think I said earlier I just wanted to get this this obligation over with as quickly as I possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
I think if the times had been different, if the military wasn't held in such disgust by a lot of people, especially my peer group,
mm-hmm.
You're
talking about the media.
Well, I'm talking about the media. I'm talking about the way you got treated when you came home.
Mm-hmm.
I think I mentioned about people like Senator Kerry didn't help.
Mm-hmm.
The military was just, not held in high regard.
Mm-hmm.
I think if it had been different, I could have seen myself as staying in the military. And looking back on it now, there's no way I could have seen myself doing that at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But as I look back at it now, I think that the military should have been held in higher regard, and it was a shame that the country treated its military forces the way it did in those couple of decades.
Well, did you all feel negative effects, or rather, what effects did you feel, if any, from the anti-war movement while you were in country?
I guess there was a lot of mixed emotions, because I had friends back in the States who were very anti-war, and I think I said this earlier that were trying to convince me when I was about to get drafted that I should go to Canada, and I understood their viewpoint, and I don't and before I was getting drafted I wasn't thinking that this war was someplace we ought to be, and we ought to be working our ways to get out of it. I understood where those folks were coming from. But on the other hand, I never understood why, you would hold it against, you would hold the politics of the Vietnam War against the soldiers that were fighting it. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of us who were very confused about that issue. I didn't understand why if I had gone and done what I thought I was supposed to do, that I had supposedly done something wrong.
Right. Did you know that? No, I had not done anything wrong. What's going on?
Right. I also understood how, I think at least it hit me hard. I mean, when I was over there, Kent State happened, and I just couldn't believe that it had gotten to the point back here in the States where, National Guard were firing on students. I mean,
yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
It just blew my mind that a guard unit would find a group of students intimidating. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's because I'd been in the field and I was up against some real people who were intimidating.
Right.
But how could you fire on your own folks? I mean, it was just absurd.
Steve, let's talk about a couple of things in country. You were made squad leader. Can you tell me about that and why and how that happened?
Well, can I go back to Dragon Valley for a second?
Of course you can, absolutely.
Because the guy that got put on the helicopter ended up getting a Silver Star out of that.
Okay.
Because after we got him on a helicopter, the helicopter got about 15 feet off the ground and it was shot back down. So we had to go back out and get Jerry out and get the helicopter crew out and get them back to our perimeter line. And at that point we were taking we're taking incoming if the helicopter got shot down.
Yeah.
But at that point the helicopter gunships came in. We had I think there were F-14 fighters dropping napalm on the hillsides while we were attempting to get another helicopter in and get Jerry out of there and get the helicopter crew out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And so as the second helicopter crew. So a second helicopter came in to land on the other side of the first helicopter. My squad went out in front of the helicopter, between the helicopter and the wood line. We're laying down a base of fire along with the of the the gunships that were in the area, because mm-hmm. the gunships had to kind of lay off for a little bit because they want to make sure they didn't hit the helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And we started taking fire again, and we got the helicopter up in the air, and Jerry got a Silver Star because he had his M16 with him,
mm-hmm.
and he's firing at the wood line from the helicopter with a bullet in his stomach.
Wow.
Which was a rather amazing feat, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we got back, and we got another helicopter in to take the broken helicopter out. And then we spent one more night there, and we started walking out of the valley with I think a lot of gunships overhead trying to protect our flanks.
Mm-hmm.
And the first squad that Jerry was in at that point had been walking a lot of point. And their point guy hit a mine as we were coming out of this valley. And so I think that they had, between Jerry and a couple other guys, that had like one guy killed and two or three guys wounded,
mm-hmm.
during this whole thing. And so at that point, we decided that we needed to get off the trail, and they brought my squad up, and that's when I started walking point.
Okay.
So we cut our way through this pretty heavy jungle, probably for quarter of a mile until we came out into an open area, and we could see a village down below and lots of people running away from us. And a couple of guys said, open fire, but I couldn't tell. As far as I could tell, I would have been shooting at women, and I didn't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So we went down to the village and ended up looking for weapons and found a lot of weapons and tunnels and whole nine yards. And as I remember, they brought another company in, and they kind of took over from there, and they kind of flew us out of there at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember Dragon Valley a lot.
What else happened there that you remember?
Well, that's pretty much. I mean, we had it was probably the biggest sustaining firefight that I was in during the time I was in Vietnam. One guy killed and a few people wounded,
mm-hmm.
and I'd heard later that a number of companies had gone in there and gone out of there having received the same kind of treatment, and it was another example to me of, you know, why don't we just, you know, if that valley is so bad, why don't we attack it with force?
Mm-hmm.
and
you all were discussing that. Or think you were thinking this?
I was thinking that, yeah. You know, what are you dragging us in there for? You know, to end up being where you're at a disadvantage, and because they got the high ground, and I, you know, you're almost like you draw the fire, and we'll bring the gunships in, and you know we'll you know, wipe them out by, you know, heavy artillery. Well, they're shooting from, you know, inside jungle canopy. It's, you know, hard to see those guys.
Mm-hmm.
You got to go in there and you got to go in there with enough force to clear the whole thing out.
What would have done that? What kind of force would have taken care of that?
Well, I would think a couple of companies where you can really work your way through the jungle. I mean, you know, there was another incident where I was in country. We were operating out in the same area, and you know, we stumbled across what ended up being an NVA base camp.
Hmm.
It was the only time that while I was in country that the tactics of how we were going to approach this place changed in that and I wasn't walking point that day. The squad who had been the point squad found us, you know, they were on the periphery of what they thought was, you know, a number of hooches,
mm-hmm.
that looked like BC or NVA. So we went online. Switch to going online. You know what I mean by that?
Yes, but go ahead and describe that for people who will not know.
It's if you're facing up a hill, which is what we were, and it mm-hmm. was a pretty heavy wooded area, but it wasn't really jungle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to my right, if I'm facing up the hill, there would be a line of soldiers. We'd be spaced going out probably. Nearest soldier to me is probably 5-6 yards away on my right, and the
mm-hmm.
next soldier is on the right of him another 5 or 6 yards, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And on my left, the line strings out just the same way in the opposite direction.
Right.
So we're going to march up this. We're going to not march. We're going to go up this hill on in an online attack position.
Mm-hmm.
And you used to see a lot of that kind of stuff in when you watch World War II movies and.
Right.
You know, World War One movies, but you didn't see a lot of it in Vietnam because normally, you know, you're walking in a vertical line as opposed to horizontal line, and it's a lot of guerrilla warfare. So you're getting attacked and laying down. But this was really taking an offensive position.
Mm-hmm.
So none of us had ever really done this in, except for back in boot camp, never had done it in Vietnam, and we were all very nervous of what we were going to find on the top of this hill. And we got up there, and it was a few shots were fired, and I think we killed. It wasn't my squad, but the squad down the I don't remember if it was right or left, but killed a couple of what turned out to be NVA.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly we were upon a. There must have been, 15 or 20 hooches
mm-hmm.
That were all very well kept. One of them was a hospital with all of the operating tools and gurneys and IVs and. There were tunnels everywhere. So this was, pretty big deal. And I think we were operating at, I don't remember if we were operating at company or platoon level, but we suddenly realized in being amongst all these hooches that, at least in my mind, that there weren't enough of us.
Right. You could sense that, basically.
We could sense that we had stumbled upon something that was bigger than us. And we were trying to blow stuff up as much as we possibly could with the ordnance that we had.
Mm-hmm.
At least I did, and I know the guys in my squad wanted to get the hell out of there
mm-hmm.
Before all the people who had been here earlier came back,
right.
and wanted their stuff back.
Right.
We called in artillery, but I think what was ultimately decided, and we heard it as we were, because it was getting towards nightfall, and so we started coming off the hill. This thing was on a very big hill,
mm-hmm.
but it was, you know, probably single canopy jungle. It wasn't really, really thick.
Yeah.
So we came off this trail, really, came off the top of this hill and found a trail and really humping it down this hill. And when it got dark, everybody sat down, laid down on the trail. We'd never done this before,
mm-hmm.
Where we didn't have enough time to really set up positions. And we slept on that trail that night,
mm-hmm.
in a just along the lines of the trail. And guard, you know, it was every other guy was awake, and then every other guy was asleep all night long. But I think that they eventually brought in that night. They bombed that place with B-52 bombers.
And I presume you heard that, felt that?
Yeah, we heard and felt that, yeah.
Can you describe what that felt like, what it sounded like?
Well, if you've ever had, you know, you're in a good thunderstorm,
mm-hmm.
and you've had a bolt of lightning go off, you know, outside your window, you know, within,
mm-hmm.
you know, in your yard.
Yeah.
And you know that thunder, and it rattles the whole house.
Yeah.
That's the closest I can come to describing it. Is when those things hit the ground, man, they rattle the ground.
How do you deal with that, Steve? Or is that just part of the reality of being in that war? Yeah, I mean, that sounds like a silly question, but how do you just get used to that? You can go, wow.
You don't ever get used to it, you know, in my...
I don't see how you could.
I'll tell you a story that I was back in country, back to the States for a couple of years, and I was living with my girlfriend who was I'm not sure if we were engaged at the time or not.
Mm-hmm.
We were in bed one night. It was like 1 o'clock in the morning or something, and just such a thunderstorm as I described to you, it came along in that evening, and we had a large bolt of lightning and a huge thunder, and I was under the bed.
Really?
I mean, I was off the bed and looking for a hole to crawl into.
Wow.
And my wife kind of looked at me. I mean, she was a little frightened and angry all at the same time. It's a funny story. And she, you know, I said, what are you mad at me for, you know?
Yeah.
And she goes, well, how come you're not taking me with you? If you're so afraid, you know, what are you leaving me up here for? You know,
she's got a point.
All right,
but
the point is that you know you know it. I guess you don't ever get used to it.
Yeah, yeah.
Although you know, thunderclaps these days, I'm not crawling under the bed anymore.
How long did it take you to get away from that?
I don't. Well, it took me, you know, for a while, for a few years, I didn't want to go to July 4th fireworks,
mm-hmm.
But by, you know, 1976, the 200th anniversary of the country, I guess I'd been out of country for 4 or 5 years. I remember going to some fireworks,
mm-hmm.
On that July 4th. But I don't think that you and I could have had this conversation 10 years ago.
Why?
because I worked so hard for so long to just kind of put it behind me,
mm-hmm.
and I really didn't talk about it very much at all. And I until just a few years ago, I had never been to my unit reunion, and had no urge at all to go.
Why not? Is it part of the effort to put it behind you?
Yeah, part of the effort, I think, to put it behind you. And
what prompted you to go?
9/11.
Really?
Yeah.
How so?
When that happened, I just, you know, the first thing that came to my mind was incoming. You know, I just couldn't believe that somebody was attacking our country.
What did the emotionally? Did you just okay? I need to reconnect, or how did you make the connection? So okay, I need to go back and deal with this issue.
Well, I've just made a whole lot of things just come flooding back, because the last thing that I think that anybody who has ever been in combat, who has ever been in a war zone, wants to see is that war zone come to where they live.
Mm-hmm.
Most Americans have no appreciation of what that can be and what that can mean. And what a terrible situation that it is.
Mm-hmm.
So when I saw those planes going to those buildings and people running for their lives in New York and people jumping out of buildings, you know, I'm seeing a war zone.
Yeah.
And really, it all came flooding back.
How did you deal with it?
Well, you know, I got on the internet and I found the AmeriCal website,
mm-hmm.
and I found the pages on that, you know, and I found the 5th to the 46th. I found the 198th and I found the 105th to the 46th and
mm-hmm.
And then there, I don't know if you've been on there, but on that mm-hmm. website, it has all these, you know, notices from guys who have served in the units in Vietnam. It usually start off with something like, can you hang on one second?
Sure.
Needed a glass of orange juice.
That's fine. Okay, go ahead.
Usually starts out with something like looking for, sometimes it's as specific as somebody's names, but in my case, what I found was a notice that says, looking for something to the effect of anybody from Charlie Company, 5th to the 46th, 198th. And I looked at that and I went, holy shit,
mm-hmm.
I can't believe somebody is out there actually, you know, looking for somebody who was in that unit. And I think they even said 1970, so it actually took me a few days before I decided to go ahead and write back. So I wrote back to I've forgotten who it was. There were two guys' names who were looking for, but one of them was Dave Hammond,
right?
And I was living in Beaverton, Oregon, which is just outside of Portland. And it turns out that Dave lives like 5 miles from me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sent him a note, and next thing you know, we're meeting each other for the first time in, I don't know, 30 years or so, in a little restaurant and having a beer and looking at each other's pictures.
What was that like?
It was very strange. I don't know that there's any way to describe it. I think both Dave's wife, Christy, and my wife Sharon, mm-hmm. you know, we all met that evening, and I, you know, it's.
So you didn't go by yourself. You took
your
wife.
Sure. You know, because my wife is, you know, she's very curious as to how this is all going to go, and
right.
you know, we talked about this off and on for a lot of years, you know, and I, she's a psychologist, by the way. So
perfect.
So
I'm married to one, also.
Are you?
Yes.
She's always encouraged me to talk about this, but has known, you know, that I was kind of reluctant at the same time.
Uh-huh.
So she was very curious to see how this was all going to go, and it's funny how it worked out because she and Christy ended up being, you know, best friends almost right away.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. Because I think the wives share in a lot of this too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they just kind of. They understand probably better than anybody what you went through as without having to actually go there.
Right.
So at these reunions, I mean, you see almost a bond grow between the wives as much as between the guys.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed that at reunions. I've clearly seen that. What is that relationship like? I mean, that's got to be very unique in and of itself. The wives, the spouses, bonding over what?
Well, they're in many respects they're living with the same kind of you know, person. I mean, they're all of their husbands have got a shared experience that's kind of unique. To their neighbors' husbands' shared experiences. So, you know, when you get together at these reunions, you know, as much as there's a brotherhood amongst the guys, there's almost a sisterhood amongst the women
mm-hmm.
because. You all kind of become brothers and sisters, if you will. It sounds kind of hokey, but I think that best describes it.
Well, that makes sense. I'm not sure people who have never been or don't know would understand that. But,
right.
But that does make sense. Steve, are you okay on time today? Would you like to take a break?
No, I'm okay.
Okay.
I'm okay for what time is it? 8:30. I'm okay for another 10 minutes or so.
Okay. Well, maybe we should leave other incidents in Dragon Valley for another conversation. If things come to mind that you'd like to talk about, I would like you to discuss those. I wanted to ask you something you mentioned a few minutes ago, and I know you probably saw this more than one time, was napalming, napalm being dropped. Can you describe what that's like to see that? What does it sound like, feel like?
It's well. First off, when I just saw it a few times.
Mm-hmm.
Once when actually I was on stand down and Chulai got rocketed one morning,
mm-hmm.
and I've forgotten how many rockets came in, but it was quite a few. Anyway, whatever company's on stand down is kind of the reactionary company if something happens to Chulai. So, you know, we were all pissed off because, you you know, what's a few goddamn rockets, you know?
Right.
But they, you know, they cut our stand down short, you know, and I mean, within a half an hour after that rocket attack, we were on helicopters on Hueys heading out to what they thought was the location of where the rockets were launched. And we got out there, and sure enough, there were a bunch of rockets there, and I think we killed a couple dinks, and I may have captured another one, and we captured a whole load of rockets.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of the VC, and I think they were VC, had headed up into these hills, and so we called in for an airstrike. And it was the first time I'd seen napalm. And first thing, when you see, it's not like any other ordnance that's coming to the ground. With these, napalm is, and I've only seen it coming down from the air, but it seems like it's a canister that's probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 inches wide and about 2 or 3 feet long,
mm-hmm.
and it kind of tumbles end over end as it's coming towards the ground.
Right,
and then when it hits the ground, there's a sheet of flame as this thing, I guess, must slide across the ground that goes up from, you know, and my sense is probably 100 yards long, maybe longer than that.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was great at the time. You know?
Yeah. Why? Why did you think that?
Well, burn those son of a bitches out, you know? It sure as hell took care of the jungle cover or the woods that they were hiding in, because there wasn't much left of it after that, you know, it got on fire. And I never saw anybody burnt by napalm or was up close any more than what I just described. You know, at that point, it was at a distance. It was sheets of flame, and you know, we didn't hear any more from the enemy after that. At least that day.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine it's pretty intimidating.
Yeah.
The American.
I'm glad we had it and they didn't.
Yeah. The American firepower that was able to be brought to bear on the enemy. What did that do for you all psychologically?
Well, there was just never any doubt that in my mind that if push came to shove in a face-to-face confrontation, we were going to win because we had that firepower.
Yeah.
But that's why the other guys, you know, were smart not to take us on
mm-hmm.
head-on
because
mm-hmm. they knew that would be a losing battle.
Mm-hmm. Steve, why don't we go ahead and break for today?
Okay.
This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Stephen Dant. Today is May 11th, 2005, and it's about 8:29 Central Standard Time here in Lubbock, Texas. And Steve, you are in Colorado Springs. Steve, tell me a little bit about when you became squad leader. This is right before you took a job in the rear.
Well, I guess I had gone back to the field after I had been wounded and kind of found myself as, since the squad was fairly new, except with the exception, I think, of one guy, kind of found myself as the de facto squad leader, if you will.
Okay.
Although while we were working with another squad, it was for the most part, since they had more guys who had been in the field longer, they were kind of taking the lead. But in terms of the group of guys that I was with, you know, was just everybody was just kind of looking to me because, well, I kind of been there longer and had more experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we went back to, so we operated that way for I think a couple weeks out in the field.
What was that like for you, being squad leader? Was it a good position to be in as far as leadership?
Well, I felt like it was an awful lot of responsibility. I was kind of proud that somebody, you know, decided that I guess I had the makings of taking over a squad. But it's scary at the same time because it's 8 or 9 guys that are kind of looking at you for okay, what do we do next? Not so much when you're with the platoon or with the company because I mean that's kind of decided by somebody with a higher grade than mine. But
mm-hmm.
if you're out on some kind of ambush or whatever, I mean you're the guy that's responsible for making sure things happen and people come back safe.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did you find yourself kind of functioning? Were you good, do you think? Were you adequate?
I wasn't a squad leader long enough to know that really.
Yeah.
And I, you know, when the word came down when I was in the rear that they wanted me over at brigade headquarters, I had a lot of mixed emotions about, getting out of the field. I mean, I didn't for a moment hesitate to take the rear job
mm-hmm.
after being out in the field. I don't know whatever it was. 7 months or whatever.
That was a pretty easy decision.
But I did feel guilty about leaving all those guys behind.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they would have thought I was crazy if I'd have stayed.
Right.
Because there wasn't anybody who wouldn't have traded me.
Were they happy for you?
Yeah.
For you?
Oh yeah, everybody was happy for me, and I was happy for myself. But
yeah, do you remember what they were saying to you?
Oh, you lucky son of a bitch! You know,
uh-huh.
I hope you remember us when we come back to the rear. I mean, everybody, you know, it's kind of a thing where everybody gives you a hard time, but they're laughing about it at the same time.
Right.
Yeah.
How was it saying goodbye? What do you say to people like that who are going to be staying behind and fighting that kind of war?
As I remember, you know, you just, you gave everybody a hug and, you told them when they get back on stand down, come look you up so you can go have a beer with them at the EM club.
Mm-hmm.
Or I remember when I was in the rear, when Charlie Company used to come back to come back on stand down,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you're in the rear, you've got a hooch. You got you lived in a Quonset hut that
mm-hmm.
was divided in two by a wall in the middle, and then there were 4 bunks on each side.
Mm-hmm.
You were bunking with 3 other guys,
mm-hmm.
and it was a pretty nice arrangement after being in the field. Well, I used to invite guys back to my hooch when Charlie Company was on stand down, and you know I'd go out and buy a couple of bottles of bourbon or scotch or whatever, and some beer, and we sit around drinking, and they'd crash and burn at my place as opposed down at the company stand down area.
Right. So you actually did see them again.
Yeah.
Did?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
As time went on, I knew less and less of the people who were in the company because a lot of guys were rotating out.
Sure.
And then I ended up extending my tour duty since I had a rear job, because if you come back home, if you come back to the States with less than 5 months active duty left, they don't assign you to a base. You just sign out of the Army.
Well, let's talk about what happened in the rear. What was your job, your assignment exactly?
I was a driver for Brigade S3,
okay,
which is operations, and so I was a driver for this major who was head of S3, and I from time to time drove around some other officers in at Brigade headquarters.
Mm-hmm. Where was this? Where was Brigade headquarters?
It was in July.
Okay.
And I was a gopher, you know, go for this, go for that.
Sure.
Ran a lot of errands. You know, I pulled guard duty at night probably, I don't know, you know, and I don't remember exactly, but I probably had guard duty like three times a week, out on the Chulai perimeter.
You want to describe what guard duty was? What did you do?
You went out to an area that was on the perimeter. Most of the time, we're out in an area that we're kind of staring out a few hundred yard expanse into the village of Chulai. And we were in a elevated, there were bunkers underneath, and there was an elevated observation platform that was built that had a roof on it, and a couple radios in there. And I think there were four guys who assigned to a bunker every night. So I can't remember if that's right. Three or four guys. So you had a couple hours on and a couple hours off, that kind of deal. And you were looking for VC, trying to get into the trying to get onto the base. I can only remember a couple of times when I was out there that something was going on, and neither time was it in the area that I was assigned to. Chulai was a pretty large base.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, I've forgotten, it must have been miles long, probably a few miles wide as it extended along the coastline.
Yeah.
So you could have, you know, dinks in a wire and be a couple miles away from where that was happening.
Right.
One of the unique things was we had the village all out in front of us in our position, and it was amazing at dawn that every morning, like clockwork, the entire village would come out into this field it must have been a half a mile between our perimeter and the village. But the people in the village, they'd all go to the bathroom at the same place.
Oh yeah.
At the same time every morning, it was like a communal bathroom break that happened in front of the entire line. You know, we always found that amazing.
Yeah, I mean, if they would come out the same place, same time.
Same time every morning.
And so you were
hundreds of them. I mean, it was amazing.
Yeah, you were out there on guard duty watching this.
Watching all this, right.
Yeah. Okay.
Strange things happen in Vietnam.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Well, tell me, what other incidents happened? You said there were only a couple times where you felt like there was something going on when you were out there.
Really, it was kind of mundane duty.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was... Compared to being in a field, anything that you did in the rear was a cake job.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why I extended to stay over there for a couple months.
Yeah.
A, I could get out of active duty earlier, and B, I found out where my orders were cut were for Fort Hood, Texas, which means I was going to be riding a half track or a tank around in the out in Texas someplace,
right,
playing war games, and I just couldn't see myself putting up with that bullshit, you know, after going through what I went through in the field in Vietnam. And besides, like I said, I mean, the chances of you getting hurt in the rear like Chulai, having a rear job, there's more chance you get killed in an automobile accident on the roads in the U.S. I mean, it's just having a job in the rear and having a job and being out in the bush are just, I mean, it's 180 degrees in terms of the experience.
Yeah. What about getting rocketed and attacked at the base?
We had a few rocket attacks. They were, you know, in the time that I was in the rear, I think you probably could have counted them on, I don't know, there couldn't have been more than five or six times where rockets were fired into the base, and the VC, you know, who I assume were firing the rockets, you know, I never felt like they had a very good aim, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They would come into the perimeter, but I don't ever remember hearing that somebody got hurt from a rocket attack that came into Chulai, at least when I was in the rear. They landed someplace, you know, where they didn't cause very much damage.
Mm-hmm. So when that did happen, it was pretty relatively tame. They were just kind of lobbing.
Yeah, well,
there.
People would head for their bunkers. If you were on the, you know, I think that there was a type of detail that was supposed to react to get out to further secure the perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't ever remember doing that. But I could have, you know, I just don't remember.
Right. Okay. Steve, why don't you go ahead and describe your quarters and kind of your basic living area, where you would eat, your basic amenities, things like that.
Well, as I said, my quarters in the rear was a Quonset hut.
Mm-hmm.
It was made of metal. It was a building that was had two rooms basically. It was and there was a wall in the middle that cut it in half, and then there were four guys that lived in each part in each room.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a small, you know, bed similar to what the same kind of bed you had in basic. I mean, it was not, you know, we had I think I'd scrounged some bookshelves someplace, and we all had our foot lockers.
Mm-hmm.
We managed to buy a small refrigerator where we kept mostly beer.
Mm-hmm.
I purchased some catalog company that was affiliated with the base or something, a reel-to-reel, a Sony reel-to-reel music system.
Mm-hmm.
you know, with speakers and microphones and the whole nine yards.
Mm-hmm.
And almost every Quonset hut, every hooch, I swear, had some type of reel-to-reel music system.
What kind of music did you all listen to? What did you hear?
Oh, well, we listened to, you know, Armed Forces Radio during the day usually, but at night you could order tapes, and people would share tapes and you'd dub them. I mean, we listened to all the music of whatever was going on back home.
Mm-hmm. What songs come to mind? What do you remember?
We got to get out of this place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of Eric Clapton, a lot of Janis Joplin, a lot of you know, the Beatles, you know, just all of the groups that were Rolling Stones, just all of the groups that were very popular at the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What else would you all do for entertainment?
Well, we spent a lot of time at the AM Club,
mm-hmm.
just telling stories and bullshitting with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Meals were mostly taken at, you know, at the mess hall. You know, there were issues of. Biggest problem in the rear, I thought, were the race problems.
Really?
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, there was just a lot of tension between the black, and I saw them as really kind of militant and belligerent black guys, you know, who for whatever reason, you know, I guess maybe some of them had some very good reasons, but had real chips on their shoulders and seemed like were always looking for trouble.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of black power salutes.
Mm-hmm.
I know that there are times where they would refuse to salute officers, you know, and it just created a tension that just always seemed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you really, you know, it got to a point sometimes where you really, if you're gonna walk back to your hooch, you'd better be with a couple other guys as opposed to walking alone.
Really? It was that dangerous?
Yeah.
Wow. Did you ever see any incidents, fights or people getting in each other's face and arguing about this stuff?
Well, I think I told you about the incident where we came back on, when I was out in the field, and we came back on stand down, and one of our guys got beat up by a few black guys in the EM Club, almost caused a riot.
Mm-hmm.
But I never got in a fight in the rear. I used to like to play, you were talking about what did you do for entertainment. I used to play a lot of basketball. I wasn't a great player, but I was a pretty good player. I could hold my own.
Mm-hmm.
He was usually on one of the A pickup teams, and there were quite a few scuffles on the basketball court.
Really?
You know, between sometimes the white guys and the black guys, you know,
uh-huh.
and
yeah.
push it come to shove, a lot of threats that, you know, we're coming to get you later. But I never saw anything like that really come to pass.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So do you think that a lot of people say the culture, the attitude of the United States kind of came to Vietnam with you all. Would you say that's true or not?
I guess if you look at the race relations and the tensions that were going back in the States at the time, yeah, I guess you'd have to say some of that showed up in Chu Lai for sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Steve, tell me about you mentioned going to the EM club and things like that. What was the deal in the rear with drinking and drugs? What did you see?
Well, I saw a lot more. Hang on one second.
Okay.
There were a lot more drugs in the rear. You know, when I was in the field, it was just a given that you weren't, you know, going to be smoking any dope or doing whatever the drug that you were going to be doing if you were out in the field. I mean, it just. I just did not see any drugs, anybody smoking any pot or whatever, when we were out in the field. And in the rear, though, there was, you know, there were a lot of drugs, but I'm not sure it was any more prevalent than what was going on back in the States at the time. You know, you were talking about the culture of what was going on in America following us to Vietnam, and I think that's probably true with regard to drugs as well. You know, there was a lot of pot that was being smoked in the rear. But there was, you know, a lot of beer getting drunk in the EM club. But I, you know, when I got back to the States, I mean, you went out and hung out at bars too and drank beer. So I'm not sure that it was that much different than what was going on back here.
Right.
The difference was the purity of the drugs that were available there, and particularly the I knew of one guy who was hooked on heroin and his habit, you know, in Vietnam cost him probably, I don't know, $1 a day or something. But he went back to the States, and that same habit was costing him, you know, instead of, you know, $50 a month, maybe costing him $500 a month back in the States, and so he couldn't afford to live here. And I, you know, I never met one of these guys, but the stories that were going around were guys would re-up or volunteer to come back to Vietnam, you know, and they'd live in the rear, but they could, but by coming back to Vietnam, you know, and again, the jobs in the rear weren't all that tough, and you could afford a heroin habit more than you could afford it back in the States. And you know, I did know a couple guys that a couple of hooches down from me that, you know, had a problem that they were going to have to deal with when they got back. There was no question that these guys were doing some kind of heroin or sticking something in their arm.
What was morale like? Did this affect morale?
Well, I don't think morale was very high. You know, in 1970 and early 1971 in Chu Lai, I don't think that the drug issues affected morale as much as, you know, how the war was being fought. And well, I'll tell you what affected morale more than the drugs was the racial issues.
Really?
Yeah. You know, because again, it just brought it wasn't like being back out in the field. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong, but there was a certain tension that was prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
That certainly had an impact on morale, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't all, and I don't want to give anybody the wrong impression. It wasn't all of the black guys that had chips on their shoulder, but there were more than a few.
Mm-hmm.
that felt that they were pissed off at the world for reasons that I can only surmise, and I wouldn't pretend to explain.
Yeah. Did you all have access to religious services?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you partake?
No, I'm not a I was brought up Catholic, but I've become kind of an agnostic.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in the field, it always bothered me when somebody would say, well, you know, what's going to happen is going to happen, or if there's a bullet with my name on it, I guess that's it's preordained. And I always I always kind of felt like, I wanted somebody around me who felt like that they had more control of their situation than leaving it up to a deity someplace.
Right.
Because I didn't want to believe that if we didn't work hard that we could get done what needed to get done and get out of there.
Yeah.
And it was going to be up to us, not somebody else.
Well, is the saying true that there are no atheists in foxholes?
Yeah, somewhat. 'Cause even though I consider myself an agnostic, I think I had some kind of Buddha thing around my neck. I think I had a rosary. I had, I was covering all the bases.
Yeah. Just in case.
Just in case.
Okay. Did you talk to ministers, or were they around, any of the chaplains?
We had a chaplain come out to the field. If we were out in the field on a, I won't say every Sunday, but probably we'd see a chaplain in the field a couple times a month.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what the denominations that they were, and most of the guys who were out in the field, if a service was held, whatever it was that would be attended, it would be pretty heavily attended.
Mm-hmm.
Wherever we were. Sometimes it's strange. Sometimes they'd be out in the middle of a field, and sometimes they'd be in the jungle. And I've forgotten how many helicopter flights I've taken.
Yeah. Well, on another subject, what kind of contact did you all have in the rear with women?
Mostly with Vietnamese women. Very, very rarely with American women. We would see them every once in a while over at the USO. I always thought they were kind of weird.
The American women?
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. I just some of them were, goody two-shoes, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't hang around the USO a lot. I only went over there when I wanted a piece of information or a newspaper from some place or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally, you'd see Army nurses, but not very often. But most of the women we came in contact with were Vietnamese women, particularly the women that worked on the base.
Mm-hmm.
And each of us had a Vietnamese girl who would clean up our hooch.
Mm-hmm.
We called them hooch mates.
Mm-hmm.
And they would shine our shoes and make our beds and sweep out the hooch. And, you know, I forgot it cost us nothing.
Yeah.
you know, maybe a buck a week or something. I don't remember. Maybe it was more than that, but it was cheap.
Mm-hmm. Did you trust them?
Yes. I trusted the girls that worked with us. They were very nice. You know, I sense they you know had an education. I think that for some reason it sticks in my mind. I think they were Catholic, but I had heard some stories about some guys who'd gotten ripped off by
mm-hmm.
the hooch mates. But I think that they knew that if they did that, they weren't going to be on the base.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'd be kicked out, you know, they'd get fired, and
mm-hmm.
it was a good job for them.
Yeah. What about the stories of the civilians being members of the Viet Cong, the ones who could come on the base?
Well, I didn't see that. I didn't run into very many, I did see some civilians from time to time, down at the PX, but most of the civilians that I knew on the base were women.
Mm-hmm.
So, could they have been Viet Cong, or could they have Viet Cong members in their family? I guess so, but you know, my sense is that. They liked the fact that we were there.
Mm-hmm. The civilians did.
The civilians did. Yeah. You know, I felt badly, you know, that when the U.S. ultimately left there, that, you know, those people were getting, you know, if they lost that war, they were going to get hurt.
Mm-hmm. You definitely had that idea while you were there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong, you know, we're going to there's going to be a price to pay by the South Vietnamese if we left. There was no question in my mind.
How did you feel about that at the time?
Well, I don't know. You know, it's just a lot of, you know, I guess you can tell it's a lot of mixed emotions about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you feel badly for them, but again, I when I was in the field and I was working with Arvin troops, you know, I never felt like that they were truly gung ho about defending their country. So on the one hand, you'd feel sorry for the people that you met in the rear, who you felt like their hearts were in the right place,
mm-hmm.
and yet you felt like that this was a group of people who are a country that, for whatever reason, I mean, couldn't take care of itself.
Why do you think that was the case?
To this day, I don't get that. That I don't understand that mindset. I don't want to generalize everything, because there were you know, the Kit Carson scouts that we work with, and those guys were good at what they did, and they
mm-hmm.
and they were gung ho.
Mm-hmm.
But my sense was that the rank and file soldier that was in the South Vietnamese Army just was not. You know, not very capable.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't get it. The Korean troops that I ran into there, I mean, they were a gung-ho bunch of people. I ran into Australians just once or twice. I mean, those guys, you know, were good soldiers. The Americans, I think, were good soldiers. But the people that we were fighting for had the worst army in the field. It's just another example of how Vietnam was just so screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
And I've read other things since I've been there, but we should have done a better job, I guess, of helping those people help themselves than we did.
How do you think we could have done it differently?
I don't know, but that's again a higher pay grade than I was. But
mm-hmm.
I think maybe if we had forced the issue more.
Mm-hmm.
It's like raising a child. If you do everything for them, the child never really takes responsibility for himself or herself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe we took too much responsibility and should have forced the issue with the Vietnamese to take on a bigger load.
Earlier.
And I don't know if that would have worked or not. It's one of those seems to me issues.
What was that like for morale? That must have not been.
Well, that's part of what affected morale. Uh-huh. You wondered why you were there.
Mm-hmm.
Those people, wouldn't do a better job of fighting for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a morale issue in the field. You get depressed, but it's one of those things where you kind of shake your head.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell are we doing here? If these guys won't stick up for themselves better than what they're doing.
It's going to be difficult.
But at the same time, you felt sorry for them because you knew what was going to happen,
Did you all really know that they're just going to get their butts kicked? Or did you think, okay, yeah, we don't really know exactly what the end game will be.
I knew if we left, they were going to get their ass kicked.
Really?
Absolutely.
Why so certain?
I knew that in 1970 when I was in the field.
Really?
Yeah.
Tell me why so certain.
Well, just kind of what I was saying before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was one time we were out in the field with, there were a few times we were operating, but I remember the one time we were operating with them and we got into, a short firefight. The VC attempted, or maybe it was Armin, attempted ambushes, and we returned fire, as I remember, the firefight was kind of short-lived, as most of them were.
Mm-hmm.
And you turn around and those guys are gone.
Yeah.
It's their country. I mean, they should know. How to take on this enemy better than we do.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they never showed that.
Were you guys like, you know, what the hell is this?
What the hell is this? That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why I say, you know, if we'd left, those guys, you know, they weren't going to be able to stand up to the VC were, you know, you had to give them that they never gave up. I mean, they persevered.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they just kept coming at you in little bitty skirmishes, you know, and they didn't, you know, like they say, you know, there wasn't a battle in Vietnam that was won by the VC or the North Vietnamese, the NVA.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing with most skirmishes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know, only one time that I know that the VC, well, twice, in the time that I was there, that you could say that they won that one. I mean, the rest of the time, I mean, out of all the firefights and ambushes and everything,
mm-hmm.
at best it was a draw, and usually there was some kind of, you know, I won't say usually, but oftentimes there was some kind of blood trail leading back from where they had attacked us.
Mm-hmm. But did that matter?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, so you kill five of them or two of them, and you wound two or three. I mean, did you all think that mattered or that was significant?
And
I'm kind of playing devil's advocate here.
No, I understand what you're saying. It did and it didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my point is that those guys never gave up in trying to win their cause, no matter how what's the word I'm searching for?
No matter what they faced, no matter the difficulties.
Well, that's right. No matter the fact that they just couldn't beat the U.S. Army.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they just kept coming. They didn't become demoralized by the fact that, you know, they'd be doing all this hit and run stuff and not getting anywhere, at
mm-hmm.
least militarily.
Why do you think they did that?
But my point is that they had a lot of perseverance.
Yeah.
But I don't think the South Vietnamese had that same kind of characteristic. I mean, I think that the South Vietnamese and the NVA were just adamant that however long it took that they were gonna win this thing, and I never understood that if you really believed in your country and your people and what you were fighting for, why the South Vietnamese didn't feel as fervently about this issue as the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong.
What was up with that? Why would they continue coming at you guys?
You mean the VC?
Yeah, the NVA and the VC. I mean, why the persistence in your mind?
Well, because they felt like they believed in what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had they just believed in their cause. At least in my mind, they believed in their cause more than the South Vietnamese believed in theirs. And so in having those strongly held beliefs, I mean, that's why they said, well, however long it takes, we're just going to keep after this.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose that they could also read some of the handwriting on the wall of what was happening in the States at that time with, you know, the anti-war movement, and you know, while they weren't winning on the ground, they were in Vietnam. They were certainly you could probably say they were winning the political battle in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the United States military forces lacked that urgency? And that might be a simple question, but there's more to it, you know. What was in our minds? I mean, we obviously had the firepower, we obviously had the ability, but in the field, was there a sense of urgency that you saw that we, on our side, did not have?
Boy. never been asked that question before.
Yeah.
You know, no, I don't think that oh, hi. Bye, you found it. Okay. My wife just came back in to grab something. Was there a sense of urgency for us to win this war as a grunt on the ground?
Or was there a lack of a sense? Did you see? I mean, what around that? I've heard many veterans, not necessarily the Vietnam War, just describe in wartime there's this underlying sense of urgency. Even if it's a slow day, you're just hanging out and nothing's happening, you still feel that. And I'm wondering if that was the case on the ground there in Vietnam for you, for what you saw, your personal experience.
Well, I guess the best way I can answer that is go back to something I said earlier in another one of sessions. There was a frustration in the field oftentimes that the rules were such that it made it more difficult for us to win, and so it goes back to, you know, how much political clearance do I have to have in order to get call in artillery on a position that I'm receiving fire.
Mm-hmm.
So when you when you're, at least when I was in the field, you know, there was there was a sense that, you know, we could have fought this a different way.
Mm-hmm.
and so in a sense we were asked to fight this thing with one hand tied behind our back. So thinking about this now, you know, my answer is I'm not sure that there was an urgency by the leaders to win this thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. Absolutely. And it's something that I have heard before.
That this was more of a we're going to put you guys in harm's way and see how this comes out.
Well, that's
you know,
that's nice, you know, for you all.
You know, because you know, that, you know. You fly out on all these missions,
mm-hmm.
and you dropped in it, you know. You dropped into an LZ zones, or a landing zone, called them LZs, and
mm-hmm.
You know, you kind of wonder sometimes why you're here. And I suppose, you know, it's because somebody spotted some enemy or whatever, but, you know, I just, a lot of time, it just seemed like a lot of time chasing your tail.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting way to put it. Let me ask you this. Is this, it provides a great visual as well. What? Or a sad visual. What this feeling you had, especially about the leadership, is this something that you developed in the field or in the rear when you were back there, kind of watching and listening and observing?
Well, there wasn't a lot of love for the leadership. You know, I don't know if I told you this story, but we were out in west of Chulai someplace, and we had been humping around the jungles. And you know, we heard that the colonel was you know, we knew he'd been flying around in his little loach or whatever, or his helicopter, and we were going to be staying in this one spot for a day, so we had to take down some trees and I don't know if you know, but clearing an LZ took a little while, you know,
mm-hmm.
because especially if there were a lot of trees, you had to, and basically what you did was you wrapped a little plastic explosion around the base of the tree, depending on how big the tree was, depending on how much plastic explosive went around it, and then you put a charge into it and blew the trunk of the tree in half, and then hauled it off to the side, and so he finally had enough clearing where some helicopters could land.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was the case this day, and the colonel was going to come down and visit our company. Before the colonel would come down, everybody had to empty their weapons, the word around was that if you were found with a loaded chamber,
mm-hmm.
You were going to be subject to court-martial.
Wow, they were that worried.
Yeah.
What kind of statement does that make you all? I mean, that
you know,
is...
I'd forgotten about that until it just popped in my head a couple of minutes ago. I mean, but that... What it said was he was afraid of getting shot by his own men.
I mean, there's the total statement of a lack of trust here.
Yeah.
I mean, I can only imagine how that made you all feel.
Well, sure. I mean, we're out in the middle of nowhere. You know, we have no idea. Well, I guess we did. You know, kind of knew what enemy was around. But
mm-hmm.
here's a whole company of men. You know, that basically have been told to stand down with their weapons. Out in the middle of the bush.
That's, yeah. What did you see in the rear toward this? I mean, was this kind of attitude was there amongst the leadership that you witnessed? I mean, you drove these officers all day.
Well, right. And actually, the relationship between the guys in the rear, the you know, the clerks and the gophers like me, I mean, was... was pretty good with the brass. I mean,
mm-hmm.
because we did work with them all day,
mm-hmm.
you know. And you know, I actually worked with the sergeants more, the top sergeants more than I worked with the majors and the colonels. But
why? Just because they were your direct contact?
They were my direct contact. But you know, there was a few times where, you know. You know, the major wanted to go up, some village that was like 20, 30 miles north of Chulai.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, loaded up the Jeep, and I think I took one sergeant and a major, and, you know, we all drew M16s, and, you know, and I drew a couple grenades and that kind of thing, and drove them up there and drove them back.
Mm-hmm.
I think, by the way, one of the reasons that you know, most of the drivers, the guys that were gophers were guys that had been in grunt units. I think the majors wanted, when we did take them off of the base, wanted somebody at least who knew how to fire a weapon. And where, you know, and I'm not saying anything negative about ramps, but mm-hmm. you know, a lot of times, you know, guys who come to Vietnam and get rear jobs from the very beginning to the end, I mean, I never lock and load.
Yeah.
So I think I'm off on a tangent here, but
that's fine.
But the leadership in the rear, you know, I think had a pretty good relationship with its clerks and drivers and what have you. Whereas in the field, there was, you know, as by example I just said with regard with the weapon stand down when the colonel shows up. There wasn't that trust.
Mm-hmm.
we were never sure what the guys were thinking or doing. But I don't know if that's much different than any other war. I don't know maybe the grunts in World War II in Korea felt like they always knew what was ahead of them. Where, you know, ours was more of a guerrilla warfare all the time. At least where I was at. I think
mm-hmm.
the guys that up on the DMZ had it maybe a little differently.
Right. Okay. Steve, you want to break for today?
What time is it?
It's about 9. Well, your time. What is it? It's 9:25, 8:25.
I'm good for about another 10 minutes.
Okay. Let me ask you then a couple other specific questions about the rear in general. Tell me about contact with home. Did it improve in the rear, and how did that happen?
Contact with who?
With home, with the United States.
Oh, with home.
Family, friends.
You know, I probably wrote more letters when I was in the rear.
Mm-hmm.
I sensed that I made it a point to let my parents know that, you know, I was out of the field and no longer in I don't think I used these words, but, you know, things were a lot easier, a lot less dangerous. You know, because I had, when you go to Vietnam, somewhere in the process, you have to fill out this form that says that if you get wounded, who do you want notified, do you want the notification be for, and I don't remember exactly how this went, but did you want, if you were only injured slightly, did you still want a notification going back to the States? And I had filled out the form that I said, unless I was seriously injured, I didn't want that notification going
mm-hmm.
back. So I ended up writing a letter to my parents to tell them that I had been wounded, because I was afraid maybe they'd get notified by it anyway, and that I was
mm-hmm.
fine, I was recuperating, and so on and so forth. So, you know, I knew that they were probably very worried at that point. So I just, once I got to the rear, I really made it a point to tell them that I was out of the field and out of a lot of danger, and I think that I wrote them back. I guess I had an opportunity to write them back more often.
Mm-hmm.
And um, So, did I answer your question?
You did. And I guess what you said is you wrote more, and you didn't really tell them everything.
No, there were opportunities that you could do a, you know, like a radio telephone call home.
The Mars calls.
Yeah, right. And I just, I never did that because I just felt like it would make me feel worse. Especially if you still had months to go and you heard from home. It was like I didn't take my R&R. Everybody gets an R&R in Vietnam, a week off that they can go someplace, and you know there are five or six places that you can go, like and Hawaii, Australia, Thailand, a few other places, and I waited as long as I could to go on R&R because I felt like if I went and then I had to come back to Vietnam and do another 6 months, it just would seem interminable after having a week off in some place where you know you could wear your civvies all week.
Mm-hmm. So you waited as long as possible.
Yeah. So I ended up going to Bangkok for a week. After I had gotten a rear job,
uh-huh.
I could never, I would see guys who go on R&R when I was in the field, and then they'd come back from Hawaii or Bangkok and be back in the field again. I just, oh man.
I mean, you're saying that's got to be just unbelievably hard.
Just unbelievably difficult, yeah.
Okay. Well, we can talk about Bangkok next time. I want to ask you about that, what you did.
What I remember of it.
Yeah, what you remember. You're there a week, but you remember about 20 hours maybe.
Something
total.
Like that.
Yeah,
right.
Okay. Well, why don't we go ahead and break for today, Steve, and
All right.
We'll pick up another time. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you.